Welcome back to Hash Rate Up. Today is all about Hash Branch. I sat down with the CEO of Hash Branch, Tom Merkel, a brokerage company which he would describe differently in the industry. We're talking about that part of the business, how he helps ASICs find hosting and vice versa, and all the crazy stuff he's seen over the years, as well as where he wants to take the company after the halving and going into all the other halvings that are coming up. Stay tuned. Enjoy. All right, everybody. Like I said in the introduction, I am here with Mr. Tom Merkel. Hi, Tom. How are you?
How's it going, Jesse? Good to be here.
You are CEO at Hash Branch. We're going to talk about what it is that Hash Branch does and the type of service that you provide, how that sort of weaves into the industry between ASICs and energy and hosting providers. But before we do that, I recorded a show earlier today, so there's not going to be much difference in the block height. We're at 838785. Hash rate is still at 606.1 exahashes on the 30-day, and the hash price currently up a couple cents from earlier, $113.87 per petahash per day. Tom, before we get into the weeds, give people a bit of background on yourself, please. Who are you? How did you get here? And why Bitcoin?
Yeah, no, really appreciate it. So my name's Tom Merkel. My Bitcoin story, I studied math and computer science in school. I did not study Bitcoin. I think a lot of people got into it and did not study Bitcoin specifically. I kind of got into the world of software engineering and did that for a better part of around 8 or 9 years, kind of just in traditional software. I worked, from engineering to product roles to different kind of roles in the software space at a few different companies. And around 2016, 2017, I started to really dive into Bitcoin, very specifically. I played around with some altcoins and things like that, and never could really wrap my head around what was going on. But Bitcoin really felt very, very unique in that sense. And so, kind of rode the market 2016, 2017, really just as an investor, kind of a layman. And then after that market cycle is when I really started to go into the weeds and read the white paper, kind of read whatever I could get my hands on. And then around 2020, I was near the end of a time at a company I was at for a while, and I was really looking for something new, something to dive into, and kind of was obsessed with Bitcoin and very quickly, became obsessed with Bitcoin mining. So during my day job, nights, weekends, all my waking hours, I was learning about mining. I was trying to build altcoin miners in my garage and then, trade for Bitcoin immediately, and maxed out the power I had at my house, got really friendly with the power company, really kind of as a passion project, just really started to figure out how much power could I actually consume in a single family home, and kind of started to grow from there. And at that point, I was pretty dead set on jumping into the mining industry full time. I was at the end, like I mentioned, of a pretty solid kind of career in the software side of the company I'd been at for a few years. And I really just jumped in the beginning of, I think it was end of 2021, beginning of 2022 is when I really just took the leap and jumped into the mining industry full time. And I started really with not much other than I have a few skills and I want to build in the mining space and really kind of learn what this is all about. And so kind of went down the rabbit hole of this industry and then looking at it from all sides, and then figured out that, I wanted to build a mine. I wanted to build a facility. So for your listeners, I wanted to build a 1 megawatt kind of starter facility where I was self-mining as well as doing some hosting. I had identified land, kind of infrastructure, power, all the necessary components. And that's where actually I met my co-founders at Hash Branch. We were all doing this at the same time in different ways. My co-founders were trying to find a way to deploy money into the space through hosting. I was trying to build a hosting facility. And I really just got to the point where I was about to deploy. I was about to do all these things. And a few things set me back, but a big eye-opener was really had to do with, once I build this thing, how do I find customers? How do I know who's real in this industry? How do I, make a lot of these large purchases when everything's facilitated on Telegram, Reddit, WhatsApp, all it just it felt like the industry had a lot of things that still needed to be solved. And so that's kind of where HashBranch, the idea for it and kind of the execution and stuff came. But I'll stop there and then maybe I can get into that.
I'll argue some of the parts of the industry are still haven't evolved much from what you just described.
Right.
This what you just described was mining at your home. You know what that made me think of is, and I'm going to date myself here a little bit. When I used the modem at home and my mom couldn't use the phone,
right.
It's kind of like turn off the ASIC. I need to use the toaster, maxing out your home until the fuses fly off the wall.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Amazing. Okay, another story, follow up, Tom. As you said, you were doing into you went into software engineering.
Yeah.
What do you think made you go into mining versus like core development or lightning infrastructure or something like that, which is a bit less or more, I want to say, more suited to the typical software engineer? I don't know if I'm.
It's a good question. So I explored it, and I even explored what other things could I do in the space, that is Bitcoin. And I think the thing that I couldn't get out of my head was that no matter what is built on top of Bitcoin, whether it's scaling technologies, additional, whether it's Lightning, whether it's different node software, like whatever it is, mining is kind of the fundamental. In my opinion, the fundamental backbone to why the entire Bitcoin network works. It really kind of was clear to me that the whole thing works because of proof of work, and that, no matter what happens, it seemed like mining was the thing that was here to stay underneath Bitcoin, right? So it felt like a bit of a, in a weird way, a bit of a safer bet in an already kind of new and risk on industry. So that's one component of it. I think the other piece was a bit of my, although I was a software engineer and I did things in the software space, like the problems I was working on were around supply chain management and frankly, like software automation. And so what really kind of struck out to me was there's an interesting intersection between those problems from a software perspective that I was working on and like some of the things that the mining industry really needs and is trying to learn, and almost bootstrap and invent kind of right in front of us. So it was just like a combination of the critical the critical piece of Bitcoin mining as infrastructure, as well as like some other problems that I'd worked on in the past, and it's just pretty cool. Like I think there's nothing like walking into a mine and just feeling like all the fans and everything, just kind of and understanding how much power is actually being used. And there's something kind of visceral about mining and real that was a pretty cool tractor. I don't know. I could probably keep going here, but there's probably.
I think you're conveying the feeling very well. I think I run a mining and energy podcast, but I haven't seen large mega farms myself. The largest farm I think I've seen myself was a 20-foot container in rural Kenya, and I can very much echo the feeling you just tried to describe. Like you go into the middle of nowhere. It's a private off-grid environment. And then there's this container next to other containers that are producing power with hydro and solar and so on and so forth. And you go into that container and there's like, I don't know, 200 M30s sitting in there.
Right.
And all of a sudden they will all come to life as basically the grid is not balanced.
Right.
They come to life and start humming. And that is, it's an insane feeling. Especially if you think about, previously to balance the grid, they might have like a heating element in the water that would, heat up the water and basically waste the power to balance the grid, right? And now instead there's a 20-foot shipping container full of machines that just all start humming at the same time. It's a pretty, pretty cool feeling.
I think even to just echo that a little bit, when I was going to build my mine originally, I really was like, hey, who else is out there doing this? And I met a miner that I didn't even know existed. And he was like 2 hours, away from where I lived. And I was like, oh, what the heck? Like there's a guy doing this. And he offered me to come out and tour his farm. And I went out there and this guy is just kind of in the middle of rural, I live in Idaho. He's in the middle of rural Idaho, just building like this awesome mining farm. And he's now one of the more impressive mines I've ever seen. Just kind of doing it based on economic incentives. Like no one's telling him to do this. No one's, you know, there's no top down kind of directive. It's just being done. And I think like the innovation at the edges is really interesting to see all across, you know, the US and the world, but it's happening everywhere. So
okay, I have one ASIC here that here now it's getting to winter in Cape Town in South Africa. And so that thing heats up the office.
Love it.
But there's like, it's similar to how Bitcoin teaches or has taught me so much about money and financial markets and all of that stuff that I was never taught, right? If you start mining yourself and expand and grow, like all of a sudden you learn about HVAC and you learn about power and you learn about how you put switch gears together and transformers and all of that stuff. Like, and all because you're incentivized to do it because there's money to be made. Tom, Hashbranch, what is Hashbranch and why is it unfair to describe you guys as a brokering platform?
Okay. I'll take those two questions. Maybe I'll go back to the end of my story. So like when we were going to build this mine and kind of facing a lot of these problems in terms of who do we talk to? Who do we trust? How do we know what other people are saying about different people in this industry so we can make good business decisions? We just didn't have anywhere to go. And so as a really a simple side project, I kind of just built a very simple review listing service for anyone who is in the industry, any miner, any operators who are running, any mining businesses, hosting companies could create a profile and then get reviews of customers. And so just kind of created that as like a side project thinking that, oh, this will be useful for us later. And what happened was it really, started taking off in the industry. And very quickly, I was, overwhelmed in a good way with people saying, hey, this is great. Here's why. Hey, this is horrible. Here's why. Hey, here's what we need. Here's what we hate about it. Here's what we love about it. So it was just clearly we had struck a chord with something we were trying to focus on. And from that, it kind of evolved into what it is today, which I would describe Hashbranch really as a purpose-built marketplace for the Bitcoin mining industry. Where we're just effectively trying to connect high quality operators with high quality customers looking to deploy ASICs with those operators. So very simply, we're focused on the hosting side of the industry, and maybe we can dive into that. I think your listeners might know a little bit about that, but we go out and identify the highest quality operations and then give you the visibility, transparency, and the ability to connect directly with them so that you can deploy ASICs in a really transparent manner. And so we're a much, much broader concept than a broker, although we do work with brokers, all the time, right? I think brokerage plays a really important role in this industry.
But it's a very broad term too.
It's a very broad term. And so for us, like while we broker on occasion, we work with brokers, I would say we're building a marketplace platform. And so our focus is the hosting space, but there's a lot of other components of this industry that really need, the ability to connect and do business in a very transparent and like I said, trustworthy manner. This entire industry is run on Telegram right now. I know Jesse knows this, but I don't know if your listeners do. And so the way that like hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars worth of commerce are done is people on Telegram finding other people on Telegram and then like wiring them money or sending them Bitcoin. Like that's the state of the art.
He has a USDT address. Yeah.
It's frankly a bit for the people in the industry, I think people were kind of used to that, but for anyone looking from the outside looking in or even anyone who's currently, it's just not ideal. And so we're trying to solve a bit of those problems, and I'll pass back to you.
No worries. I mean, it's great. It's good background. What I think you miss is highly super important is that you are a independent platform. Especially for retail, you want to start mining because again, like Bitcoin, people who are into Bitcoin stumbled there like you and I somehow. And it was probably about curiosity right now, right?
Right.
And so sometimes I feel like for Bitcoiners especially, it's the hardest to just hold on to your stack and not try to do anything funky with it because that's almost in your nature, right? You want to try things out. You want to make mistakes. You want to learn, blah, blah, blah. And so mining is like one of the natural next steps, right? People approach me all the time, say, oh, I want to get like 10 ASICs, I want to get 5. It's like, what's your approach? Are you trying to, are you going to sell your stack to cover your bill?
Right.
Just buy Bitcoin. You know what I mean? But again, what I'm trying to say is these guys or these folks that then approach me, they will have outside of me only so many options, and all of them are not objective, right? Because right. they're all trying to sell a service, and they're trying to sell their margin for their machines, and they're trying to sell their sites, which they make another margin on. And all of a sudden, the deals people are presented with are absolutely ludicrous, where mining and hosting is absolutely no fun.
Right.
And so what I want to say is, I think when you pitch this, the subjective or the objective part that you guys bring to the table, where you could say, hey, this hoster, nope, this hoster, good, there's space there, go with them, even if they're slightly more expensive. That is, I think, very, very valuable.
I would definitely agree. So that was kind of from the get-go. You know, I mentioned we originally were trying to build a mine. We abandoned that, and we do not own, you know, infrastructure. We do not own a hosting company. So we're not, you know, building this marketplace to just funnel to our hosting business. That's, you know, completely the opposite of what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do is say, hey, what are the objective ways you can just assess quality across this industry? And then, frankly, the highest quality people we should match up together, because in that way, you know, better business will get done, but also, you know, the Bitcoin mining industry will just be better off, right? And then therefore Bitcoin and all these things. For us, we do it in a very objective way, right? So we do due diligence on our operators. We do a ton of things for that, you know, getting uptime data, reviewing contracts, making sure that they actually have the land and the power and the site that they're trying to sell. So you kind of little secret in this industry is half the time, you know, when someone says, hey, I have capacity, it's someone else's capacity that they're trying to sell, or someone else's person that they know, like there's like 9 levels of it. And so we really try to get through to who's the actual owner and operator. Sometimes it's the same group, sometimes it's different groups. And then who has the ability to represent this, what we call rack space. And so by doing that very intentionally and just being transparent about it, people realize that the things that we're able to discover and the people we're able to point in the right direction, they're just better off because we haven't, you know, obfuscated all this information and tried to make it more complicated. In fact, we do it in a much simpler way than currently is done. And that's on the operator side. And so for the customers, what's interesting is, you know, we have to look at both sides, right? So we look at it from a customer's perspective, and this is like the person sending equipment, the person buying the units. What do they need to see in an operator, right? There's a whole bunch of different things, whether it's, you know, location, uptime, you know, how long have they been around? What are the customer reviews? Are they, you know, are they real? Like a lot of things. But for the operators, there's a similar problem. You know, if I have a customer that sends me units, there's a lot of risk with taking, you know, bad units, or a customer who's not going to pay on time, or a customer who's just going to, you know, not treat me well as an operator. Like there's a double-sided nature to it. And so we try to kind of step in and just say, hey, you know, operator, this is a good customer for these reasons. And customer, this is a good operator for these reasons. We make the connection happen. And then, you know, that's how our business runs.
I would argue, though, that you probably have a lot more leverage or a lot more mass to sort of deal with on the hosting side, because at the end of the day, you know, and also it's not a perfect balance, right? If I give my machines to a hoster and they're bad, they just unplug them and I'm screwed. If I don't pay them, they unplug my machines or sell them or whatever, and then I'm screwed again as a customer, right?
Right.
So I don't think it's a 50-50 balance. Like the hoster has a lot more power over the machines and compared to the client. And so I think the service of DDing or you doing proper due diligence on all these hosting facilities is the way to go, or is in that scenario much more valuable.
I think you're right in to a certain extent, but I do think there are, like, I think it is, you know, generally the industry, the operator has a lot of control just because they're the ones with the equipment. They're the ones that can do whatever they want with the equipment while it's on site. But you know, generally the operators we work with, like, they really do the right thing and they're honest and they work hard, you know, and they are working really hard to do this stuff.
Sure.
And so, what I've seen, interestingly enough, is situations where bad customers actually hurt operators, you know, maybe not the same, but it's a different type of, so I'll give you another scenario. You know, a customer identifies an operator and then just starts shipping units. Like, this is kind of a funny, you know, this has happened multiple times, especially when the market picks up. where no contract has been signed, no payments have been made, there's nothing, and units are just showing up, right? So like pallets of units are just showing up, and like these aren't cheap units, right? So these are just, so the operator's trying to weather this kind of, how do we make sure these are deployed? Whose are these? Kind of, there's a lot of complexity there. And then once they start getting plugged in, now you have a bit of a risk where if that customer doesn't pay for the hosting fee, you know, a large component of that hosting fee is the power rate. The operator's the one who's on the power bill. So they're on the hook with that. So there's these constant tensions that we try to balance. And I think by being that independent marketplace kind of facilitator for this industry, it gives us a really good visibility to say, hey guys, here's how we're going to get this done and everyone's going to be happy. And so, yeah, it's a really interesting problem because depending on the market cycle, it's one side or the other.
How do you get around that though? Like, how do you get around referring customers to hosters that end up shipping them pallets of ASICs unannounced?
You know, it's a good question because I think this industry is a little Wild West. And so you kind of like that, you know, you like the ability.
It is.
I think, you know, we're working on a few solutions to help basically, you know, with deployments and make things a little easier. And just, I think the biggest thing comes down to setting expectations with all parties. And so, you know, customers knowing that, hey, if I just ship my machines, they're not going to be on in the next day unless that was part of the expectation set, and just kind of balancing those things. But yeah, I think you'll always have, you know, the cowboys who are just willing to send their stuff wherever to get it plugged in, you know, at the right moment.
What do you DD on the hosting side? You said lease, PPA.
Yeah, we make sure, you know, they
can get reviews.
Yeah, we do a handful of things. You know, some are more objective and some are more subjective, but kind of all of them together really make up a good amount of quality control. And so at a very high level, you know, making sure they have access to the power that they're trying to, you know, use, and making sure that there's not a ton of risk there, making sure that the hosting contract, you know, is reasonable, you know, that you'd be surprised some of the things that we've seen in hosting contracts that just kind of, you're like, that seems crazy in the fine print.
And like what?
You know, there's hosting contracts that we've seen, you know, that are out there that basically say the equivalent of, if you ever try to end this contract, we own all your equipment, like stuff like that. And it's like, okay, like, but isn't there some conversation? So things like that, or, you know, just unrealistic expectations. But for the most part, operators, you know, they have reasonable hosting contracts, and a lot of them are just to kind of cover their bases and things like that. So just making sure that that's legitimate. We make sure that the pricing that's being represented, the terms are the same that are reflected on our platform and that have been communicated. You don't want a situation where customer gets matched up under one kind of, you know, some terms of a contract, and then the operator changes them last minute. That's not a good experience. You know, land, making sure that, like I said, they at least own or have a lease agreement that we trust, that, you know, there's not some risk there. You know, we make sure again that the business entity is actually real and is in good standing. That's another one, you know, make sure they're a taxable entity so you can actually do business with them. You can find these guys. That's kind of, you know, high level stuff. Go ahead.
Can you verify whether they have legal trouble? I lost you there for a minute.
Oh, sorry. Could you repeat the question?
Yeah, sorry. I lost you there for a minute. My connection's a bit shoddy. Can you verify somehow whether these operators have legal trouble?
Yeah. So like possible? as part of when we look at the company, the entity itself, we can understand like if there were lawsuits in the past, like what that currently, if they're currently under litigation, things like that. And we're getting better at this over time as we get more information, but that's always a good kind of thing to check for. Those are all kind of just high level, making sure you know who you're getting into business with, because at the end of the day, these relationships are business relationships. From an operator quality standpoint, right? Let's assume you've crossed all those, you've checked all those boxes. We do things like measuring uptime of the, you know, customers that get placed, you know, just making sure that basically our way that we think about uptime is, you know, uptime is an interesting word. It's subjective depending on who you talk to. Is it the machine was on, it wasn't hashing? The thing that we really care about at the end of the day is how much hash rate is getting delivered versus the hash rate that was expected to be delivered to the pool. And that's, when I say delivered, I mean from the mine to the pool. You can think of operators really in the delivery business. They're making sure that the hash rate gets sent to the right pool and it's like above a certain threshold. Like that's really the measure that makes the most sense. And so we track that, and we have an internal system that says like, what does this look like over time for customers we've placed and others. That's like another kind of, it's subjective like a little bit, but it's a bit more objective on the data side. And then we gather customer reviews, right? So we still kind of back to our roots. We're still a review. So we still have a review system, and all of our operators can gather customer reviews, both from customers we've placed with them, as well as other customers that have had good, bad, or just, normal experiences. Operators can review, or sorry, can respond to these reviews. And we also aggregate reviews from all across the internet. So you have Trustpilot reviews, Google reviews, it's all on the platform to kind of get at a subjective component. And then there's other things we do, and it's really, it has to do with like, where are these operators and in geographies, right? So for example, like, are they in a place that is going to be a little bit more humid or dry or have more weather risk? Like there's other assessments done. And then I think the last thing, I'm kind of just riffing here, is really subjective, but it's important to us. I meet all the operators we work with, like video call, ideally in person. We've gotten site videos and all these things at this point, and some of them we've done site visits for, but like I build a relationship with them, and you can kind of start to figure out how people do business through whether they're willing to turn their camera on, for example, on a call. That's like a very simple one in this industry, and I understand everyone, a lot of people want to stay anonymous, and I think that's important. But at the end of the day, if you're in a business, like, and you're expecting someone to send you a ton of money, you need to be able to have some like willingness to show who you are, in my opinion.
So. Yeah. But a lot of people will not ask for that, Tom, because they don't think or they think it's weird to say, hey, like, can you turn your camera on? I'm about to send you like $10,000, please. Can I, it's confrontational. And there's a lot of people who don't like confrontation. And so then they jump into things, or they don't read things properly, or they think they're being, people with five ASICs, let's just face it, they're not going to get the best deal anyway. But if you want to do it, like, it's still a lot of money. And that's always when people approach me, and I'm sure you've come across the same conundrum. People come to you and it's like, they have $500,000 of ASICs that they want to play somewhere, right? And that, on the one, that's a lot of money, like $500,000, that's a lot of money, right? I think we would both agree.
Yes, that is a lot of money.
On the under end of the spectrum, you have the host, and they're like, yeah, that's 100 machines, I can offer you this,
right?
And so striking that balance, I think, is also as the middle man in this, is something that you have to explain to clients both. And the hoster might legitimately not think, okay, this guy is sending me five ASICs, why should I show him my face?
Right.
But I think what I'm trying to say.
100%. It's $500,000 is a lot of money for sure. But in this industry, depending on where the price of these ASICs are, it, like you said, it might be 100 machines. And just for people, listening, is 100 machines is about a third of a megawatt. And the operators that we work with generally are in between, I would say 10 to 25 megawatts is kind of the sweet spot. And so when you multiply those numbers out, you realize, if they have 15 megawatts of another, with another client, that's a lot of machines to be worried about. But then 100 machines is still a lot of money. So kind of striking that balance is something that we're able to do pretty effectively, where, as HashBranch, as this marketplace, we can effectively aggregate a bit of our leverage on behalf of customers and say, hey, we've placed a lot of customers with you, and so we expect, XYZ in terms of quality. And then we can help operators by making sure that customers have the right expectations and things like that. And so that's another aspect of this, but it is crazy when you really, think about it that way.
If you think about it, there's a lot of education as well.
Yes.
There's a lot of education. What pools do you use? What ASICs to choose? What's cheap? What's expensive? Where's the market going? Like, I have these conversations pretty frequently. What's the business model then, Tom? How do you make money in this?
Yeah, great question. I ask myself this every day, but I think the cut and kind of answer is, we're a marketplace, right? So we have effectively a take rate or a commission or a fee, you can say, on the value that we're able to transact through our platform. And so currently it's a combination of, if we place you with a host, the host will pay us some percentage of that deal that we brought them. You know, they're getting value. And then on the customer side, if we're able to, you know, one part of it is if we just match you up and then we're out of it and it's great, then the host will pay us a, you know, some sort of commission on the deal. And if we're more involved, which we are with quite a few clients, where we're helping with the deployment, we're helping kind of in an advisory capacity, we're making sure that everything's handled, we're kind of helping both sides, then there's a bit of a margin on the customer side as well, either, you know, just as a percentage or maybe a percentage of hash rate as well. So we try to align our business with the value that we're providing. And a big part of our business is really just aligning incentives for all parties. And so for us, we try to make money when the operator is successful as well as when the customer is successful, so that we're balancing those two things. That's really the crux of our business to date.
What excites you about it? What keeps you going? Like maybe before you get into that, what share maybe like something that has really gotten you down? Because I understand there was some, I think like I checked your page 1 week, and then 2 weeks later everything was blurred out, and then it was all not blurred out again.
So no, exactly. So one of the things that we've faced because we strive to be as transparent and open as possible, because we really believe that's the right way that this industry needs to evolve, is through trust, transparency. Like, we want to show as much as we can on our platform, because I think then people can make the best decisions. And so because of that, we faced a lot of issues as a marketplace with, we'll call, you know, it's called circumvention basically, or where we provide all this information, we give you everything you need. And then a customer might just kind of say, oh, cool, I'll just go direct. And there's really no attribution. And we really, you know, our whole business model fails at that point, because we've almost shared too much information, which, you know, we were trying to figure out what the best solution for that was. And so in the short term, it was an amazing kind of moment where we realized, wow, we are providing a ton of value. There's a lot of people using our platform, and we've been able to learn a lot and build a lot of goodwill. And that's amazing. The bittersweet component of it was doing the math and realizing that, oh man, we've filled all this rack space that no one knows was us. And so how do we assess for that? And I think it really came, I knew this was kind of an issue, but I thought, all right, let's kind of navigate this and figure out the best way forward. We're open, we're transparent. I don't want to, you know, stop that. And I got a call from an operator that we work with closely, and, you know, basically said, Hey Tom, this is great. But you know, our rack space is almost full, and we don't know if we'll need you as much as in the future. You know, I think there's, and I was kind of thinking, oh, you know, that's awesome. That's the whole goal here. But you know, tell me a little bit more about the customers, and kind of very quickly realized, no, these were all customers that came through us. Immediately the operator was like, oh no, those are yours. We'll attribute, no worries. Really not even the fault of the operator or the fault of the customer, frankly. I think we weren't very clear with our model. And so customers were just kind of like, oh great, we'll go around. You know, that's maybe my naive kind of take on it. And so it, for the short term, basically while this was occurring, we kind of just said, hey, let's put up a little, like we'll blur everything out and put up a little window that just says, hey, like go through us if you want to find what you're looking for. And there was backlash there, where people kind of thought, oh wow, like you got all this info and then now you aren't showing it. And it's kind of like, guys, like we got to meet in the middle some way. So, you know, we're still figuring out the best foot forward, but with that operator specifically, we kind of put together a different model, and now we're off to the races and stuff. And so just kind of that's like a bittersweet moment where we're doing everything we meant to do. But it's, you know, we have some leakage or circumvention that we're dealing with, but we've since solved a bit of that.
Yeah. I think, I mean, as also maybe often the customer, that'll look at the rate that they pay through you versus the going direct. And they, I think then the one of the solutions, you know, if I allow myself to give you my thoughts, is to make the customers understand the value that you are providing,
right,
and what they're paying for. If they don't understand that, there's more inclination to just give them a direct call or direct WhatsApp message or direct Telegram message, right? But if you make them understand, like, hey, you know, going through us gives you leverage. If there's something wrong, we've done this work. Like, we don't work for free. And whether now the hosting rate is 7.y or 7.x in the end. Doesn't really make a big difference. And all the most people want, really, in my experience, is sleep tight hosting. They don't want to buy 500,000 worth of ASICs and then 2 months later have the first issues and nobody on their side. Because it goes back to what we said earlier, right? You don't want to have to deal with legal battles. Like, you're not going to be a foreign entity or foreign private individual and then sue them in front of the court in New York. Like, it's not going to happen, right? So you want somebody on your side. And this is what you guys effectively represent, right? From the beginning till the end.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So then on the flip side, Tom, or do you want to have feedback there?
Sorry. Oh, yeah. I was just going to mention, we've since come to a bit better of a solution, in my opinion, and we'll continue to iterate on it. And really, a part of it is basically doing exactly what you mentioned, where we're starting to get in front of the clients a bit more and just say, hey, this is what we do and this is what we provide, and being, transparent about that. And, we have a new landing page that kind of describes a bit of that, and we're going to continue to add more information. And it's been successful. Customers realize, like we, another, kind of as an addition to this, had another customer that last year we had helped through something and called me out of the blue and just said, hey, you helped me, didn't know how to pay you, can I wire you, X amount of dollars? And I was like, oh, wow, that, yes, you can. That kind of solves.
You take dollars, Tom? Come on, man.
Dollar, what? I don't know what dollars are, so sorry. We still have a business to run in USD, so. But yeah, so that was a cool thing. We've started to solve that with, really awesome. through transparency of what we're going through, and operators really started to go, hey, why don't you try this and we'll work with you. And so that's really gone a long way. And yeah, I'm excited for how it evolves.
No, I mean, you just gave the perfect answer as to what keeps you going, when this stuff happens, because it can be cuck, as you say in South Africa, of people when you just do a lot of work and then you don't get anything in return. But we're also dealing with folks on the internet. That's also not always the easiest. All right. So what else? Where are you guys going next? What are your plans besides, reviewing, getting people into good hosting contracts and all of that good stuff?
Yeah, no. So our, we have a very grand vision of where we want to take this, but I'll just be, very straightforward. We're focused on hosting. We're focused on matching supply and demand of capacity with demand for that capacity in the US. That's really our core focus, in the near term. I think just that problem alone has, a ton of depth and a ton of things that need to be solved still. And so we're very focused as a business and an organization, because again, I think there's so many things in Bitcoin, right? Like, we're just talking about mining, and within mining, hosting, and within hosting, kind of this, small to medium sized thing. There's so many things that we could be focusing on, but we choose to focus on hosting very specifically because we believe that that's kind of a core function of this industry, is really, these ASICs need to find a place to go, and this infrastructure needs to find ASICs to make it make sense. So that's our very core business focus right now. And I mentioned in the US specifically, because I think international expansion is definitely an option for us in the future, but I think we need to solve it here domestically, because I think there's a lot of things that we can learn from, and then figure out how to expand that into other countries and other jurisdictions and whatnot. So that's kind of on the business side. Very tactically, we're exploring ways for customers and operators, frankly, to be successful post-halving. I think a massive amount of hash rate came online in between the last halving and the current halving. I think when this goes live, we'll maybe already be past it, and I think I think the business needs to adapt and adjust. And I think there's a lot of ways that hosting contracts can accommodate that, whether it's, profit share situations or flexible rates, different types of flexibilities there. So that's really our core focus right now.
Explain profit split deals, Tom.
Yeah. So a profit split is very straightforward, in the sense that a hosting operator has, a handful of different costs in order to run this equipment. So they have, they have to pay the people on the ground running stuff. They might have to buy parts. They might have to, replace a PDU or different infrastructure components. They have an internet bill, all these things. But that's like very small versus the actual cost of the power. The biggest factor in this entire industry is the cost of the power to run this equipment. It makes up, probably 80 plus percent of the actual hosting rate, which a lot of people don't realize. And so with a profit share model, what you're able to do is you're able to say, okay, customer who plugs this machine in, we're gonna pass the power co the cost of the power onto you, and then what's ever left over out of the hash rate, we're gonna split that between the operator and the customer. And so that's the in essence what a power pass through profit share is. And what's really interesting about that is now you have this ability for customers and operators to effectively work together as profitability or hash price kind of goes up and down, but the base cost power is always going to be taken into account. And so operators can make out very effectively in a bull market, so can customers. But in a bear market, you can keep machines online for longer because what a risk, I mentioned I think earlier in this is that a risk is that someone just stops paying their power bill and now you have to pay that power bill or you might get dinged. But if you have a flexible relationship where the power cost is always going to be covered, and then what's that, whatever's left over will, be split in some percentage based on, different negotiations. And so it really simplifies things and it aligns incentives very well because now an operator is very incentivized to keep your stuff hashing, as are you, throughout the whole engagement. There's more complexities there. How do you reconcile this? How do you figure out what percentage? Make sure the equipment is high enough efficiency that there is profit to split. So there's all these things, and I think the combination of a profit share hosting model with a fixed fee hosting model over time will probably be the best way forward.
I've seen structures where you go, up until this total revenue per kilowatt hour, you do fixed all-in hosting to cover the margin of the operator or whatever, and then beyond that, you go into a more flexible option.
Right.
There's a lot of creativity there, and it kind of goes into a question that I had written down for you. And I typically talk about this when talking to pool operators. There is this race to the bottom in whatever fees and margins that I see, right? And the more halvings we get to, the more vertical integration will matter because you can control from A to B the whole stack, right? From the kilowatt hour to the hash to the Bitcoin. And I think there is a danger in the hosting world that people don't realize how little room there is for margins. And so, I don't think it's going to be this halving or the next, but if you talk like 2028, 2030, 32, you might get to a point where there is no room to pay the margin for the operator, and then in term sort of there's less hosting to go around and less liquidity for you as hash brands to do business, right? Have you ever thought about this and this race to the bottom, and is the profit split the answer to that, or how do you see that?
I think it's definitely valid that there's a race to the bottom in terms of fees, and I think that's just across the industry. And I actually like that if you think about it in terms of the efficiency of the industry, right? If everything's kind of competing on all these things, then the industry is just getting more capital efficient over time, which is, in my opinion, a win for Bitcoin and a win for the industry. What I would say is, while I agree that is something. These operators definitely have hidden costs that are not being kind of captured, and so there's a reason that they have a certain margin that they require. And I think obviously everyone needs to make money. There's profit associated, but the reason that they include that in a lot of times is because they have costs that they can't quantify that are, maybe qu costs because the infrastructure is not built for them. Like there's no, great way to do billing and reconciliation. There's no, great system for them to lower their costs in other ways. And so for that reason, they have to make up for it with a higher margin. I think those pressures will incentivize them to find other ways to cut costs. And I think they're already doing that on the infrastructure side, the power cost side. I mean, that's kind of the first place to start. But I think there's other components of operating a mine where the costs are all, are too high because of inefficient processes and inefficient things. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity to find margin in other places if that answers that question. And so for us, like I think there's a balance between us wanting to, make more money as a business, but also drive costs down for all parties. And I think if we find a good balance, it'll just be a win-win for everyone. So I'll just leave you with like, the industry is not perfectly efficient yet, and in no, and not even close. And so I think you could infer that there's probably a bit of costs that could be reduced, across the board.
Is there a potential for like a partnership between you and a pool operator? And there may be some pools that retail customers don't have access to that you could give them access to where they have lower fees. Is that an option?
I think I lost you there for a sec, but I think the question was around, partnerships, relationships with pool operators, and I'll even extend that with,
let me rephrase.
Yeah.
So offhand, Tom, is there any space for you to maybe have, access to pools that retail clients typically don't have access to, to send folks there and get a special deal? Is that something where you, because again, retail doesn't have the same access as large, right, large miners have, right? So through your platform, could the retail customer get access to services that they don't usually, could not use under the usual circumstances?
Yeah, absolutely. So we try to work as closely with all participants in this industry as possible. And so that requires us to try to work very closely with pool operators, firmware providers, ASIC sellers, brokers, all the people making things happen in this industry. And we try to work very closely with them. And so a part of that is figuring out a way to allow, maybe the more retail type miners to have access to these things in a way they otherwise couldn't. And so pools are one example of that with, kind of aggregation and finding ways to save on fees. But there's a lot of other ways to do that as well with, kind of firmware, as well as like I mentioned, ASICs, things that like the little guy effectively wouldn't have access to. There's a world where we can help aggregate that in a way that just, provides that access, but also doesn't overwhelm the pool operator or the firmware provider with, hundreds of thousands of different requests. They can work with us for that. So definitely there's a world where we do that, and we're exploring those things today.
All right. Nice. Let's go into how you're expanding again. Is there any, did I any, miss anything on that part before we get into scenarios maybe?
No, I don't think so. I think, one of the questions that you had shared was around international expansion. And I think that is on the horizon. And in some respects, I think mining is a global game, and we all know that. And so we work with people in other countries, and we kind of think through what that looks like. Our main focus right now is the US, but I imagine a future where we're able to do the same thing abroad and expand that way as well. So other than that, I think we covered it all.
Cool. Right. Let's go two scenarios. First scenario, I'm completely new into this game. I just want to get into brass tack specifics. I want to buy 510 S19 case. I come to you. I said, Tom, what do I do? What do you tell me?
Yeah. So the first thing I ask is, have you already purchased them? And if so, like, give me everything basically, because what we recommend, to everyone is, don't buy machines until you are sure that you have locked down the rack space for those machines, whether that, is you're controlling and building everything, or that the hosting contract that you need is going to be there and you've maybe signed it or already executed on it. I think something first time miners really fall for, I think, is I got to buy the machines because the prices change and then I'll figure out where to go. And that always ends up in you overpaying for the machines, and then they sit idle for however long until you find a place, and then you're desperate and you overpay. I mean, it's just, I think it's easy to get people excited about it and they go out and, oh, I just buy machines. It's very, that's the first question I would ask is, where are you going to put them? Or have you already bought them? If not, we can kind of think through, YK pros, like what are your goals here, right? Are you first time? Like, how are you going to think about this? I try to understand, like, okay, are you someone, I think you mentioned before, where you plan on selling all your Bitcoin each month and paying for your power bill, and if and then also paying the your mortgage with the remainder, and like this is your last chance effort at a being able to pay your bill? Like, I would just say don't do that. This is that's not what you should do. But let's assume that you are a Bitcoiner and you're interested and you know that you want to get in and you've come to the conclusion that you can, that you want to start with 5K pros because maybe you have a, you know, $7,500 budget or something. You're like, I want to start here, things like that. Let's assume that's who you are. I would, understand things. We'd want to know what's your timeline, right? So, you know, kind of how are you thinking about your deployment? So in our, on our platform, when you create a request for hosting or you kind of try to contact someone, we basically ask all these questions, like, what are you looking for? What are the deployment? What's the deployment timeline? Is it, you know, immediately? Is it, you know, post-halving? How are you thinking about this? Because we just want to make sure that you're thinking about the right things before you shell out, you know, money to do this. Because I think it's very easy to get people, like I said earlier, get people excited. You know, you're like, hey, wire money here, do all this. And then now they're, the fulfillment is really the hardest part. So we try to set those expectations up front. And then let's say that those expectations are set. We'll kind of inform you that, hey, like for this type of deployment, here's what the market is offering right now. Kind of basically, here are the rates that are available on our platform. Here are the current kind of standard operating procedures for this type of deployment. Assuming all those things are great, we'll, you know, if you've already kind of locked down, you're like, hey, I already know where I'm going to buy these, or my buddy has them, we'll kind of say, okay, are they new machines? Are they still under warranty? I think there's a whole world where people buy these used machines off people and think they're, and you know, so once that's done, we'll help you kind of throughout the whole thing. So you say, this is what I'm looking for. Well, through our platform, you'll see multiple options that you can pick and choose from at either directly, or you can get bids on your business if you have a little bit more of a time or a lower time preference on that. And then from there, we connect you with the deal that you like. And if you need help procuring these machines, we'll find a seller of these machines that we trust and work with and get you kind of fully deployed up until the point that you're hashing and you kind of know what's going on and you're set up. And then from there, depending on what you're looking for, we can continue to help over time with billing and reconciliation and whatnot. And that's how I would approach the first scenario. But there's a lot more complexity in there. But I think the biggest takeaway is setting expectations and making sure that people know what they're getting into before they jump in.
This perfectly showcases again, you know, why people should pay a bit extra, especially if they're first time coming into this industry. Now, scenario two, not a first timer, already has 10 petahash running, wants to buy another 200 S21s. How do they benefit from your service offering when they've already been in the industry?
Yeah, no, absolutely. The first thing we start with is kind of similar, but it's really, you know, knowing they already know the industry. It's what's your deployment strategy now and into the future, and what has it been in the past? What types of things have you done? You know, what operators are you currently working with? What types of contracts are you going through that you like, that you don't like? What, you know, getting a lay of the land from a customer perspective to understand their goals. And then from that, we understand that they probably know, you know, if they've already done 10 petahashes here, they already know where to purchase these machines. So then we might kind of try to work with that, knowing that they've already got that on lock. Effectively, what we do from here is we're able to identify the rack space that, you know, the spots that they can place these in a really efficient way, right? So we can say across our network of operators, here's what's available today. Here's what's going to be available. And here are the going rates that we've pre-negotiated that you can play with. And so depending on their answers to a lot of those questions, you know, we'll guide them in a certain way or the other. So for example, if they have 10 petahashes at one operator, there's probably a reason that they're trying to go to another operator. Now, is that because they don't like this operator? They're out of rack space? We generally recommend, in my opinion, is to deploy with multiple operators within reason, because you want to diversify your risk a little bit, right? So if you're with one operator, they can be the best operator in the world, but if a hurricane hits or there's some unforeseen issue, your entire fleet's down. But if you have a distributed fleet, then you kind of are mitigating a bit of that, and you can get a bit more of a blended rate with those hosting contracts. So kind of would offer a bit more of a like white glove, you know, experience for this type of customer. And then just see what we can do from there. And really the deployment is effectively the same as a 5-unit customer.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I don't know if you said this while I lost you, but like you try to make sure, obviously, when you diversify risk, that the going back to the weather and stuff and the location, that the operators don't just have completely different names, but are like basically next door neighbors. Right. That's probably a factor that not too many people can assess. We are at the end, Tom. It's been an absolute pleasure. Can you please tell me, is there anything that I didn't ask that you wish I had to sort of showcase what HashBranch is all about?
No, I think it was great, and I think we covered quite a bit. So I don't think there was much that we missed here. I mean, I think the biggest thing I'll leave, you know, everyone with is that, you know, we're intending to build the purpose-built marketplace for the Bitcoin mining industry. And part of that will be us trying to work with everyone in the space, right? So it's not just hosting operators and customers, but like we mentioned before, it's pool operators, it's firmware providers, it's ASIC sellers, it's brokers. You know, we want to have some relationship with everyone who's really doing the hard work to keep this industry alive. And so we're building a platform that services all of that. And you know, that's going to be our, you know, our stance going forward. On brokerage, like, I love brokers, but I think there's too many of them in this industry, frankly. And I think, you know, broker is a kind of a loaded word, because I think there's brokers like Jesse, for example, that I'm talking to, who provides a ton of value and does a lot of due diligence and does a lot of the hard work. And then there's brokers who basically just know someone who knows someone else, who knows someone whose brother, sister, whatever, has a mind. Like, that kind of stuff
needs to stop. Have to, like, when you talk to people that don't know you, you almost have to, I feel like I always have to apologize at first for writing them and trying to solve their problem. But then again, like, this, you know, talking to people like yourself on this podcast exposes you to a lot of problems that people have, and then you just get to talking. And at the end of the day, you know, you start reeling and dealing. Like, the first thing I did with HashRateUp as a company was to, and the premise again is to bring more hash rate to Africa, right? One of the first things was to sell hosting in Ethiopia back in July, before it was hot, right?
Yeah.
And so, if I don't know, it's again, you almost have to apologize, but then it's also a lot of fun, right? To help people, educate, place them, and be sure that you're giving somebody a good experience over the next 24 months or however long the term is or whatever. So yeah, I mean, it is what it is. I understand there's a bunch coming around brokerage as well with you guys. I can't wait to get into that. Maybe when it's out, we'll have another chat. But not least, Tom, does Bitcoin consume enough electricity or not? What do you think?
Not even close, in my opinion.
Why?
Because I think that when you really look at electricity and, you know, energy consumption, but electricity is what we're talking about here specifically, the amount allocated to the Bitcoin network currently is a drop in the bucket compared to what we use for other things that don't provide nearly as much value as what I believe Bitcoin does to the world. And so, for your listeners, if you want an interesting statistic, go look up, you know, what types of services on the internet use the most energy, and you'll get a pretty interesting breakdown of the stuff we spend electricity on. And so my position is that if Bitcoin is the kind of next evolution of our financial system, and, you know, has all these properties that we care about, sound money and, you know, kind of decentralization and all these things, we should use as much electricity to support that as possible, because the game theory of mining is that, you know, the more electricity we use, the more secure the network is, because it's all kind of being adjusted in real time. So that's my take, but, you know, I'm just a guy on the internet and I love Bitcoin mining. So of course, that's probably the answer you heard or you were expecting to hear.
No, I mean, look, it is similar for most cases. I've had one person that said, no, it uses too much, believe it or not. Frequently people are now saying, no, it uses just about the right amount, just exactly how much the market wants it to use.
Well, that's actually a good point.
You know, I don't typically give my view here, but because I'm interviewing you, but I obviously am on the same page. You know, there's still a lot of abundant and wasted energy on the continent where I'm at. Lots of abundance. There's a lot of mining to be done there. Tom, tell people where to find you, where to go, where do you want to send them?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, hashbranch.com, you know, just go check us out there, check us out what we're doing. And then, you know, on, you know, Twitter, LinkedIn, I think we're just at hashbranch on all those. That you can find us there. And we've got, I don't think we have a YouTube channel or anything, but maybe we will in the future. So
nice. All right, guys, if you learned something new, you know what to do. Next Sunday, we talk mining again. Tom, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. Very easy conversation. Thank you very much. Enjoyed it. Thanks for your time. Check the show notes. Leave a comment. Do all the liking and all the subscribing. Swan and I will appreciate it. Yeah, until next time, guys. Have a good time. And yeah, happy halving to everybody, because this will be out on the 21st. The halving should have been yesterday. So I don't know. I'm going to say hash price right now is, at the time of release, it's going to be at 62.87. What's your guess, Tom?
Currently or at the...
No, when it gets after. Released, when this comes out. Half. Yeah. When it gets cut in half. Yeah.
I'll take the over. I'll say 70.
Okay, cool.
We'll see. Up a little bit.
Beer's on you if you lose. All right, guys. Cheers. Have a good time. Bye-bye.
Thanks.